Welcome to the Bread and Roses Show here on WXOJ 103.3 FM Valley Free Radio, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. Here on the Bread and Roses Show, we talk about a range of issues related to creating a fair economy and social justice. And on today's show, we're gonna talk about the question of economic justice, economic inequality, and bring the focus locally here to Northampton, where in the past 2 weeks we've had kind of a major drama around the removal of downtown benches, six downtown benches that some people felt were a place where loitering was going on and somehow discouraging business downtown, and created all kinds of response. And we have in the station here with us to talk about that and other issues that are currently certain immediate issues going on that raise the question of the political economy. What is Northampton about on an economic level? How do we deal with preserving economic diversity, class diversity in our town? We have City Council President Bill Dwight in the studio and City Councilor Maureen Carney and Breanne Zolkovich, who's a co-host here on the Bread and Roses Show. And so I welcome you all. Thank you, Bill and Maureen and Breanne, for being here today. If you may be following this or not, but Walmart workers, as many retail and service workers around the country, have been organizing. They have taken up, as of Wednesday, a strike going on in different Walmart locations. And here in Northampton, Jobs with Justice is organizing some of the local support action for next Thursday. There are going to be actions around the country next Thursday. And this is some of what the press release from Jobs with Justice reads: reduced hours, crazy schedules, no raises, firings. These are some of the legal ways Walmart has retaliated against workers who have spoken up for their rights using concerted activity protected by the National Labor Relations Act. There's going to be a caravan of including workers from Western Mass, following the model of the civil rights buses, the freedom buses, going down to Bentonville, Arkansas, what they're calling the Ride for Respect, to bring their complaints directly to the Walmart shareholder meeting on June 7th. And next Thursday, there are going to be a series of picket-like actions, or at least demonstrations, at 5 p.m. in Northampton, the Northampton Walmart at 180 King Street, the Walmart in Hadley, that's the Hadley Mall, that's next Thursday, June 6th, 5 p.m., the Chicopee Walmart. So if you get a chance, please check that out, and you can find out more on that by going to the Jobs with Justice website, Western Mass Jobs with Justice. Okay. All right. It's been pretty exciting, actually, if you've been following the news. We'll do this on another Bread and Roses show, but in the last month, there have been, I don't know if you followed, fast food and retail workers around, particularly the Midwest, but starting in late April, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, Milwaukee, and now Seattle have gone out on this strike, these kind of flash strikes.
It's a Western Mass Jobs with Justice, actually. I think Maureen and I are both kind of high up on their mailing list, and we are in frequent contact with John, and he certainly keeps us abreast of the same actions that you described. So it's
pretty exciting.
It's exciting given the large scale retail category killing systems, as they're known, actually do have a pernicious impact, particularly on local economies, and mostly through the kind of reduced quality local jobs, but also taking away community investment dollars and sending them back to Arkansas that never get reinvested back in the community. So I think I'll speak for Maureen in this respect. I think you have a couple of sympathizers in these actions. So
it'll be interesting to see how Walmart responds, just because historically organizing campaigns have been met with, in many cases, just closing. They'd rather close down the store than see a successful organizing campaign. And they've done that in numerous places.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting to see how these one-day strikes are responded to by the corporation.
It's certainly an interesting strategy. And when we talk about a living wage, and I know the city council has supported that idea, what does that mean for Walmart workers? What would that mean? And what would that mean for just the prices of goods across the country when we think about a $15 wage at McDonald's?
It's
you know, that's the issue. So it's really interesting to put it to everybody. It really kind of puts it out there to everyone in America.
There are big box retailers that have been able to do that and have been able to survive. Costco, who is actually employee owned, and they've been able to pay folks, you know, a living wage with benefits. And, you know, so there are examples. I think clearly paying a living wage wouldn't put Walmart out of business, nor would it jack the price of products up so high that they're unaffordable, as many of the discount warehouse supply chains have shown.
And Walmart also complicit in deaths in third world countries that we've seen reporting all over. And I think the objective of this campaign, and I think this is where it succeeds mostly, is increasing the consumer awareness and Americans' awareness of the cause and effect and the impacts that go beyond just finding something that's maybe 7-8% cheaper than what it would be if you bought it from a local purveyor, from the local consequences. And that's, you know, I think this serves a purpose of a message campaign. And the more headlines they make, the more feedback they generate, the more conversations. You know, and actually here to give you your transition, it's sort of like in some respect the bench issue, which, you know, I think we talked about before going on the air, that the benches are the benches, and it was just something that was easy to grasp for the newspapers and television, because it was kind of more of an overt manifestation of something deeper. And it brought out all the opinions, left, right, center, middle, ambivalent, everything else came out as a result of it. And so it just served as a launching point for a larger discussion. At least that's our hope. That's what Councilor Carney's working on. Our hope is to have a broader, deeper conversation than beyond Facebook barbs and Mass Live. Well, Mass Live, you know. It's a place where magpies congregate and scream. So that's
good. I mean, when I was trying to figure out how to frame this, it was interesting. I asked Councilor Pamela Schwartz to be on the show, and she couldn't make it. She couldn't be because of other commitments. And I said it in my email to her. These are all signs. The bus benches. The right now Smith College is demolishing. Another building in the Green West Street neighborhood, the building that housed the Green Street Cafe, is currently being demolished slow by slow. And then this building, the building we're in right now, Florence Community Center, just this week or last week was put out to bid, and very quickly one bid was submitted. The Gudgeons family. Gudgeon family was, the Finance Committee approved it, which I guess is the final approval.
No, the final approval is the mayor's but the Finance Committee serves in advisory capacity, mm-hmm. and that was the recommendation. Yeah.
So, but all these issues for me, when I sent that to her, and her response was particularly with the benches. Well, it's not just about gentrification. These different issues, and so when I was thinking about all these, like how do we talk about them? And one of the things I thought about was how do we think about what is the political economy of Northampton? The issue of property, one thing that all these things are tied by is the notion of property rights and how that's so sacrosanct, and what city government tends to respond to generally is who has property and who can do that dance best. And so, not always, but so that was, I thought part of our discussion would be just kind of trying to figure out, like, what's going on here? What are these three issues about in terms of supporting economic diversity, and is that even something people, in terms of the Green Street issue, it's done, it's already over with, the decision's been made. This question of, is Northampton gone? Is it already so gentrified that there's not even space really for working people to live here anymore. Maybe they can come and be on the streets, low-income working people, but is it already so far gone? So anyway, let's go back to the bench issue and just give us the most immediate update on that, and then we'll kind of get to the deeper issues.
Okay, I'll take that one. Well, as you know, the benches that were removed have been replaced. Everybody knows that. And in the meantime, during that two-week period, we had the opportunity to hear from loads of people, everybody on the city council, in addition to the mayor. And if there's anything to thank the mayor for, it's for really jump-starting this conversation that's been brewing, that's really been kind of below the surface, bubbling, since the last time there was a proposed...
the panhandling ordinance.
Yeah, anti-solicitation ordinance is what it was called. And, you know, maybe somewhat similar to one that was passed in Worcester in last fall and now being challenged by the ACLU. So we've had a chance to hear from people about that. And when Bill and I and a couple other counselors talked about how we might draft, you know, have a response, just because it seemed appropriate for the city council to have some response, it was one that really took a broader look at the sidewalks. And so that's why the resolution that's being introduced next week is one that's in support of vibrant sidewalks. And I take that that title really from an article that I found in an urban planning magazine called Access. And some very compelling arguments were made that we really need to consider those essential elements of a sidewalk that make it vibrant, not just a place for motion, movement from one place to another, but a place where folks have the opportunity to meet, that you can expect you're going to meet people you know or don't want to know necessarily on a street and on a sidewalk, that it's expected to in places that are, you know, full of activity, that there will be confrontation sometimes, and that might be in the form of street protests, you know, or demonstrations. It might even be something as disruptive as a sidewalk sale, where someone might feel like a little aggravated that they have a hard time walking down the sidewalk. Yet, we think it's really important to allow those things to happen, you know, to support. There aren't too many folks who would argue against having our downtown sidewalk sales. And then the third is to acknowledge that there are folks who really consider the sidewalks home right now. I mean, that's really where they eat and sleep. And be that for the good or bad, it is the reality. And so just knowing that that's the case, that there are going to be many folks on the sidewalk. And the last element is really taking our civic responsibility and keeping things, you know, lush with trees or plantings, benches, sidewalk furniture, and those are for use by all. So we drew from that. I drew in kind of drafting this from a philosophical background, but then also looking at the local plans that we've had in the city, one being one by Nelson Nygaard. They've done a lot of work, consulting work with the city of Northampton on intersections and streetscapes. And in theirs, they really talk about the importance downtown, because it's kind of, it's unsafe to try to tackle those long crosswalks. Not only that reason, but, you know, building out the sidewalk, widening it, narrow the street, widen the sidewalk so that there's more room. There's more room for folks, more room for benches and plantings, and make it a really welcoming place for all. And then also looking at other studies we've had that further consider improvements on the sidewalks and expanded seating. So that, you know, it's really pretty, it's probably less charged. It attempts to actually bring the conversation to more of a rational level. And let's say, what are we looking for in our downtown sidewalks? And acknowledging that there are those elements that for many people will be uncomfortable.
My intent is also to shift the basis of discussion on some level. You know, I think you kind of aptly described essentially an issue of property or an issue of provenance. Who, you know, all political issues are territorial, basically, by my reckoning. And we're talking about public commons and expanding the common space by which we and places that we congregate and sometimes bump into each other and sometimes create the conflict that Maureen described. And a lot of these issues are kind of motivated by an us versus them kind of concept and attitude, which is disappointing. And I think if we can start from the premise that when we're talking about the public, it's not just some portion of the public. It's not some entitled group, and every group, every person who's representative of any group thinks of themselves as somewhat more entitled than the other group. They will go after the other groups and suggesting that they're not entitled. But the point is that anyone, if you're a sentient being in downtown Northampton, or if you're in Northampton, you're part of the Northampton public. That is, and I'd like to start the conversation there, and we've got to move away from those people, and that's on either side, and it's not just two sides, as I've emphasized. This is as many sides as there are people. And you know, my frustration is that if we can get around phrases like North, you know, this is, we're a shopping destination. I've emphasized, no, we're not. We're a city. We're a city comprised of people, where people come to shop. And that's a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing because it creates part of the vibrancy. Part of the appeal of as a shopping system is it has vibrancy, the vibrancy that Councilor Carney talked about, the vitality, the human commerce, the transactions, the things that are missing on the internet, for instance, that we lose on a daily basis as these businesses struggle against online purchasers and large companies like Amazon and Walmart, as makes a larger presence. That has an adverse impact on local economic people. And consequently, that vitality and vibrancy starts to go away. There's no reason for people to congregate here. And the fact is there are people, we do not regulate or should not regulate people's comfort zones. We shouldn't regulate things the way that annoy people or disturb people. Because point in fact, if we started doing that, there'd only be one person left in town or two people. And I'm pretty sure neither of us would be one of them. And I think that we have to understand that with a common space and sharing the commons comes with it a guaranteed subset of discomfort and conflict. It's how we negotiate and navigate those conflicts. And I think part of what Councilor Carney is saying is expand the commons. It reduces the conflict of braiding pressures, create larger streetscapes and more streetscapes for pedestrians, and inviting for, you know, for the business people, it would be more inviting for shoppers. For people who just want the vitality of a vibrant city or just to contact people, to look at people, not even talk to them, there's greater opportunities there. And that actually is the very essence and the root of a community. That's just actually what a community is. And the problem is we all are experiencing some aspect of despair, economic and otherwise, and unfortunately that manifests not as railing against the system that created that despair, but railing against each other for what's left.
Well, that's one of the things that I feel gets left out of the conversation is my sense, and I want you folks to all chime in on this, is one of the biggest problems of businesses downtown is the rents, the high rents that are charged. Yeah. So when people talk about the mountain goat, they didn't go out of business because of the people who hung out front, exactly. As far as I understand. They went out of business because the winters have changed, they're selling less, which is also partly the recession. But also, from what I understand, that there's an owner of that building who is selling those prices, and he wanted them out of there.
That may or may not be, but the fact is that that's in effect what happened. And and the business pressures principally are from large scale. Here's the thing, the problem the business owners face is something that they feel they can do little about. It's very difficult for a bricks and mortar store locally owned without the buying power of an Amazon to compete on that level. And so all the things that we used to get dry goods or rent videos, for instance, from a video store, same thing is that it actually, that's a large peril that's unaddressable in some people's mind. What you can address is what's going on outside your sidewalk.
And so you're finding a scapegoat for something that's very visible.
You're just trying to find something you can do something actionable. And you're right. I think in some way, blame wouldn't be the first word I'd go to, but I don't think you're far wrong in the assessment. I think that's ultimately what happens. By the way, and I want to emphasize, this doesn't obviate the fact that there actually are some true and terrifying conflicts, and it's not irrespective of class, that occur. But the fact is, I also want to emphasize that Northampton actually statistically is one of the safest cities in the state per capita. But that doesn't matter because perceptions are and fear aren't things you can argue with. You don't argue with people's feelings. But the thing is, we do try to make sure we don't predicate laws based on people's feelings.
Yeah, and you know, the fact is that store owners have told us that some of their customers have told them that they are very uncomfortable being asked for money by people on the street. That's a fact. I'm not really sure, you know, that we can or should really regulate that in some way. I mean, as I just mentioned, the city of Worcester is facing a federal lawsuit right now by the ACLU, and not only for fear of lawsuits, but I think that there's a lot of education and a lot of opportunity for folks to consider what's going on in terms of, there's an opportunity for education even by shop owners when customers come in and say that they're really uncomfortable. They've chosen to give out the little cards there that tell customers how they can give to a social service agency rather than, you know, a person on the street. So there are many, you know, folks respond in different ways. And I think it's really up to them how they'd like to deal with their comfort level around issues like that.
Let me say, we're here on the Bread and Roses Show on WXOJ 103.3 FM Valley Free Radio. We're here with Councilors Carney and Bill Dwight, and I'm Joel Sachs, and we have Brianne Zolkovich in the studio with us as well. And we're talking about a range of issues related to economic inequality and the role of city government in this. So the underlying issues that are at stake and addressing those issues. I mean, one of the things also that in talking about this is how downtown has become so much a place of shopping. And I guess that's what downtown's become. But is there anything else that can be there? I think about the, and this is where the marketplace comes in and where money comes from. Several years ago, we had the Hotel Hilton proposal. In the Roundhouse parking lot, and with that came the possibility because of changing Pulaski Park, right? Of a new design to Pulaski Park, and I would say just on my own premises that I think more could be done with that park to make it a more usable and inviting public space. But nothing's happened because the money's not there.
Right. That's the thrust of the problem as well.
The issue with so much of this is the marketplace determines all.
I was in support of that project when it came before us. And in fact, as much as there was a lot of complaint that there didn't seem to be a public process, it had, you know, there were a lot of news stories about this. I don't know, I feel like that had been out there for a while. And one thing that I thought was really positive about the proposed project at the time was that it sought to do a lot of improvements that the city couldn't really afford around that area of Pulaski Park. And at the same time, it brought a lot of light and energy and
this is
activity.
That
stretch of Main Street is kind of dead, kind of at night. There's not a lot that goes on, at least in the evening. So with lighting, with activity, with folks then staying in a downtown, really smacking downtown hotel, to then, you know, it certainly would support the downtown economy that's right there. And it's not very likely that we're going to put something else like a manufacturing plant or something. So it would be something in the service sector, I would imagine.
And I think, you know, in the arc of history, of course, Northampton, of course, is the county seat, and that was the, and downtown was the principal commerce section. Commerce has clearly changed. We're in a flux period now, as I said, with the internet. Suddenly, bricks and mortar stores of dry goods is certainly transitioning. You can't find an app for a bar or for getting your hair done or, you know, getting a haircut or getting your eyebrows tweezed. So as it stands, or frozen yogurt or sushi for that matter, all those things will probably be, are probably experiencing less sense of economic dread than, say, the dry goods purveyors who are downtown, the galleries, in fact, actually, as well. They're all the same pressures. It has been an ebb and flow. You know, the gentrification of Northampton, as it's described, is, it doesn't really quite apply in the same sense that we experience gentrification in Boston, in other depressed economies. The Northampton, of course, wasn't a large industrial town. It was the county seat. It was the home of the courts. It was the home of
Smith College
and other systems like that. But the fact is there was a diversified economy. And not, when I say that, I don't mean it was a diverse economy of scale, but it was a diversified economy, so that it was able to survive where other communities in boomtown communities in the Northeast that are now currently Rust Belt, Lowell, Holyoke, places like that, which were all predicated on one industry that ran and owned the town. And when that industry packed up and left, it devastated the economy and left no repurposed buildings available, and, you know, just big empty buildings that really couldn't be reused. So in some level, we're lucky. But the fact is that one of the things that you talked about, the pressures of rent, we have high rents here, and that's usually set by one principal landlord who sets those rent levels, and then other landlords sort of come close to that. And
you mean downtown?
Downtown, yeah. Well, and expanding beyond downtown in some levels. And we're talking about rental apartments and things like that. One of the things that contributes to Northampton's downtown vitality is the fact that people live above those shops. I mean, that used to be the tradition throughout the country. It's becoming less and less so. It still holds for Northampton. But if you go downtown Worcester, oddly enough, the places that Councilor Carney referred to, you go there after 5 o'clock, there are no people. There's just ghosts wandering around the town. There's no people who live downtown. Yeah, downtown. You know? Well, downtown Springfield's trying to revitalize that. Downtown Hartford's the same way. These large glass edifices that are actually soulless empty boxes after 5 o'clock. And so there's all sorts of things that kind of inform it. And the thing is that Northampton, because of its vitality, has the associated sense of the systems of conflict. And what you talked about actually is a really huge concern about the pressures as Northampton becomes more and more appealing to people from all over the country who are projecting their best hope and images on the city. What happens is people who have affordable housing are being essentially forced out, or feeling that they're forced out because they can't continue to afford to support a regressive tax system of property tax. There's a caller on the line. Do we have to wear headsets?
Yeah.
We have a caller. Are you there? Hello? No?
Hello?
Oh, maybe they'll call back.
Okay.
Are you there?
No.
Okay. Sorry.
Maybe they'll call back. Well, yeah, let me just say to listeners, the number here, if you want to call in and...
The number here is 413-585-1033, 413-585-1033. I mean, what we've seen in the cycle, I mean, what you're describing is what happens in many towns. It's happened in New York City and other places where, you know, in the 1970s, downtown Northampton was dying. It was, from what I came here in mid-70s, right?
Right?
And it wasn't dead, but it was a different town. And then you had some developers coming in. And they realized this miracle, and they started developing the upstairs that you're talking about. That, from what I understand, really,
the Greenfield was the place to be in those days.
Yeah,
if you remember the billboard. Downtown.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, and that brought these people in, and the rents were low, and we had a really vital art scene at that point. I would say, having lived there then, that I think's been tremendously diminished at this point in terms of that kind of very. Low cost, very accessible, all over the place, all kinds of arts, theater, dance, music, was very, not that those things aren't available, but it's different in my sense of where things are at. It's a very different scene. And a lot of the arts friends that I have, unless they bought houses here a while ago, don't live here anymore. They have to go to Holyoke or Springfield, or Greenfield, basically, is what's happened. Let's see if we can.
Hey.
See if we can get this.
Where can I put you on the air?
Hello, are you there?
I'm here, Joel.
Okay. Hello, Elliot. Welcome. Hey, Elliot. Welcome to the Bread and Roses Show, Elliot Terry.
I'm fascinated by the discussion and honored that, or really awed that the city councilors are trying to grapple with the complexities of this issue. My thought was originally what you expressed, Joel, at the beginning, but I expressed it in a colloquial, has the horse left the barn in terms of gentrification a long time ago? And are we just in a different economic or conscious environment? And I was wondering if the city councilors and perhaps you could talk about the effect that the bid and the influence or the zone that was given to Smith College has had on planning for the commons or the idea of the commons, and particularly which was brought out by the benches. How much was the bid, the business improvement district, responsible for planning, and how much is the city and that dynamic? But also, the memory of the greening of Northampton was created by a consciousness that was kind of dominated the planning to revitalize the town with local shops. And what I see as gentrification is the dominant paradigm shifts as a different economic class comes in. It is more focused on business. So could you address any of that?
Hi, Elliot. It's Bill.
Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Good.
First, let me address the thing about the bid. Actually, the bid were very reluctant players in this particular thing, and I have since had conversations, and I think they were actually kind of opposed to the removal of the benches. I'm not sure if it was a philosophical opposition or it was just that they really didn't want to fight the fight that we just had. I think that unfortunately an emotional and expedient decision was made, and consequently the bid kind of got sucked into it. They actually didn't have any play in the influence on the issue. To the extent beyond the fact that they were the guys who ended up pulling up the benches, and I think had they to do it over again, that probably wouldn't happen. But to your larger question, actually Northampton's first heyday, its first experience heyday, was back in the days of robber barons when the large philanthropies invested in the community and built the academy, the People's Institute, and things of that nature. And those were all, and in fact, actually, the one thing I'm happy about living in the era that I do is that we don't have the days of, although there are certainly people pushing to have the days of robber barons restored, and clearly we're certainly damn close to that given the fact that corporations, for instance, have the right to protect themselves as people but never have the right to go to jail. But the fact is that was the essence of the economy. That was the essence of the structure. These large investors through philanthropies got to determine what the buildings look like. It's why we have a city hall that looks like a Lego castle. It's, you know, there's no way that someone could propose that today and make it happen. So I derive some comfort in that. Although, you know, I find it pleasant and quirky and whimsical, and I like that. But that type of whimsy is only allowed to the wealthy and entitled people who are willing to expand their largesse, their noblesse oblige, and shower it upon the poor little people who cleaned up after their horses. So I don't think we've reached that point. And I think, but the fact is that the pressures are similar. We have abdicated from taxing the wealthy. And I know this sounds like a bumper sticker, but the fact is we've, in the interest of trying to promote ourselves as an accessible economy, we keep saying we're lowering our taxes, and which is a patent lie. We're just changing the names of them. But we're moving away from income tax structure, where we used to get money from the state and federal government, to a regressive tax system, which is putting the onus on property taxes, which is not based on your ability to pay. It's based on the value that someone puts in your home. So if I bought a house 40 years ago at $100,000, say, I paid off my mortgage, I'm on a fixed income, I'm collecting Medicaid, Medicare pension, and my taxes are now higher than my mortgage was. And I can't afford to continue to pay it because I'm not going to make any more money. So what's left to you? You have to sell the house, your one asset, and move to someplace more affordable. As Joel said, you move to Greenfield or you move to East Hampton. And as a result, someone else with deeper pockets comes in and invests and buys a house of, at say, $350,000. And then consequently, you've just eradicated a portion of economic diversity in the community. It is a trend. It's hard to arrest. What we spend most of our time is trying to work on not stemming the flow, but trying to promote the development of affordable housing. That also comes with its own resistance. The state has statutes called Chapter 40B, which requires you to maintain 10% of affordable housing stock, but affordability is based on mean income. For a lot of people, it doesn't. $280,000 doesn't sound pretty damn affordable. So these are the cards that we see before us on the table, and these are the ones that we're playing with.
Yeah, I mean, the who can live in this town, and that's where our thing's gone. That's what I fear, is that I see more and more this wealthier class of people coming in, even young people. I mean, we know that the college students who are coming to the five colleges more and more are coming from higher income brackets.
Right, they're full
and their
paying
parents
tuition,
are paying, you know, their parents are paying the rent. So you have ever more students whose parents are paying the rent and can afford whatever the market will bear. And then you have these younger people coming in or people coming from other parts of the country who want to live in Northampton. And everything, houses are just, they fly. You know, whatever goes on the market is gone because there's so little available. And this question of so how do we get to the wealth? And that's where I want to just put a little light on what's going on right now with Green Street. And the Elliot, are you still there? Oh, no.
He's there. I can listen on the radio.
Yeah, okay. All right. Is it okay if I take you off just if we want another call, or do you want to still be part of this?
Oh, no. Just my question was about the bid and Smith College control, you know, the zone they were given and how that impacted the planning for the commons.
Okay. Right. So I want to bring
it
right now.
Sorry, I didn't
now.
Really answer that part.
Well, just bring it to, you know, I urge everybody to take a walk down Green Street right now and just see the house, the structure that's being demolished. They're doing it slowly because this building where the Green Street Cafe was is right butt up against another one of their buildings. There's three kind of row houses. Beautiful. I actually lived in one a number of years ago. And this one, the one they're taking down, became SRO, single room occupancy. I don't know how many units were in that, but a number of really nice units. Were you ever in the building, Bill?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, I had three friends in the SROs, and in fact, actually, when it was run by HAP, they're currently living in SROs. Sort actually, now they're efficiency apartments, the ones that were the replacement apartments that were built by Smith as part of the overlay agreement. The whole argument of that the Green Street debate, I mean, I wasn't quite in, I was at the beginning of it and at the end of it as far as being on the council. Actually, not at the end of it. It was actually more or less decided by the time I did come back on the council. But I was at the beginning of it, and it was, I mean, the fight was for the preservation of an affordable neighborhood.
Right.
Established against the principal property owners of all those properties that were managed as affordable, which was Smith as the landlord. I mean, Smith quite clearly kept those rents low with the thinking that it would make it easier or facilitate it making easier when and if they ever eventually did expand. I don't think it was quite as easy as they thought it was going to be. But, you know, and I don't discount this. I think that if they had put the rents at market rate, which, you know, clearly would the neighborhood would have demanded because it's access to downtown, they would have had wealthier people in with more wherewithal to put up an even tougher resistance or ultimately a more expensive resistance. So, and the Green Street Cafe, you know, is an altogether different animal as well. I mean, because John Chilsky.
Well, not the cafe. I just want people to walk by and see both. And this follows what happened on Belmont Ave. last year, taking down that beautiful multifamily.
Took down the and then the Italian. Right? Wasn't the two-family house where the...
No. This was a much larger multifamily. Right. It was a gorgeous building.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
And then
next to it
was this unique Italianate
structure
that they used for different art
dance
buildings. But, you know, this idea that the most efficient building is the one left standing, right? To take down really well-built buildings built during a time when... You know, the materials and just the quality of construction generally was very high when we need housing desperately. And we have a landlord, the largest landlord in Northampton, the largest landowner in Northampton, that doesn't pay any taxes.
Well, they also actually are mentally the largest taxpayer, but they don't pay taxes for school affiliated buildings.
Right. I mean, as part of the agreement that they did agree to payment in lieu of taxes.
But that's not a yearly. That's variable. There's nothing fixed in terms of what's
right. But
then
we don't. That's state law that exempts them as an educational facility.
What I'm saying, though, I mean, this is the issue of what does city and I. You know, I was part of CAN, Citizens for Affordable Northampton Neighborhoods, and was part of that. And Claire said, "My hands are tied." You know.
Well, at the time, if you recall, we did. We were looking at what was the legal precedent there, and that was the Dover decision, and it was clear that Smith College, who was the owner of these properties at that time, did have the legal right to do with what they will at the time, and so the best that we could get out of it seemed was at least this agreement, and the agreement did ensure replacement housing for all housing that was lost.
The only thing I'll say about housing. The replacement housing is Dave Boatwright, who was on here in the fall.
I know Dave.
He was one of the people who went into replacement housing. Mm-hmm. And the story he tells on Bedford Terrace, that corner building there, about management there, he said nobody who made that move over is there anymore. That it's all turned over. The rents have gone up. And so, I mean, that's something to look at, is how much has affordable housing really been sustained in those buildings.
Right. Well, as I said, unfortunately, affordability is determined by HUD standards, at least when you have these contractual arrangements for this. And I think you can make a reasonable argument that HUD standards for affordability really don't have much corollary with reality. And that's kind of frustrating. But to the extent that if you're going to make an agreement, that was, I think, given the circumstances, unfortunately, was the best we could do.
Yeah.
We could have had no agreement.
I guess, then this is where, what role does city council, I understand all of this, right?
Right.
That there is,
well, no,
there
we
is
did
a
have
law.
A choice. We could have gone to court. We could have tried to, well, first of all, foregone any agreement, not had a development agreement with Smith College, and then tried to sue. I'm not really sure on what grounds.
There were precedent suits opposing Dover Amendment, and to date, not one of them has won.
Yeah,
but the fact is that, you know, the problem is, my concern is we get lost in the weeds and something. This is not to alleviate Smith from any obligation. I actually am personally, I find maybe the original intent of establishing Dover Amendment and exempting institutions like hospitals, churches, and schools made sense at once upon a time, because these were agencies that were serving the public good and were never could stand to make any profit. Well, those circumstances have long since changed. These are institutions that have profound wealth, and as a result, though, they're not sharing the community burden. But the fact is that's again back to Elliot's question. How is Smith influencing the public commons downtown? And I would say not very much. I don't think, other than the fact that we recognize that Smith is an entity here that actually provides value to the community. But the fact is Smith isn't going to dictate the terms by which the design occurs or who gets to go there and so on and so forth.
No, and in fact, in the wake of the Education Overlay District establishment, we also then went forward with extending the Northampton Historic District up, further up towards Route 66 West Street. So it went right along that stretch as one way at least to have design standards imposed. I mean, Smith College did oppose that and came up, but we did pass that piece from the city council.
You know, my question, and this is a radical grassroots organizing perspective.
Yeah, good.
Is if the Kent City Council can, or at least members of City Council who are angry or feel that another direction should be followed, serve as organizers and rally the public and say to Smith College, we need you beyond the law, because the law is really who has the political muscle, right? The law changes based on how many people are in the street and what public opinion is. And we just saw that drama take place here where there was Narcowitz enacted his own sense of an autocratic rule. He followed, you know, he made his rule, and people were outraged. And it was simple to put the
right. I mean, I think
this was a very long process.
Yeah, I'm just going to spell out
a historical trajectory that could have been different in terms of imaging, visioning, right? We had Hospital Hill. We had beautiful buildings up there. They're all gone, and we've now got like suburban tract housing without the suburb buildings that are.
Let me just finish.
The plan there. Just we have all these plans. Like there was a plan that for the Charette. There were these plans of what that neighborhood ideally should be that were not followed. There was a plan for what Hospital Hill should be in terms of different kinds of businesses, incubator industries. There should be some kind of mixed. It's more upper income housing is basically what's. There is some affordable housing. There's some of that, but the new buildings that are up there. Now, Smith College could have put its science and engineering buildings up on the hill. It could have, instead of taking out a whole neighborhood as it's doing, and you're right, the market rents would have change the nature, but because they don't pay taxes, they could have said, we're going to support $500 rents, you know, people being able to pay or live in something like that. And instead, what we have on Hospital Hill is in my opinion, is a mess.
I think this
idea of incubator industries, we have the community gardens up there. There could have been an eco village up there. There could have been all kinds of things that a science and engineering structure up there could have fueled, as in other academic communities, there is that kind of interaction between
They weren't going to, and even that was offered. Well,
yeah,
the Ford Science Center was already approved through the planning board and everything else prior to the establishment of the Education Overlay District. That was all had already met the.
Well, this was all part of the conversation.
It was allowed by right.
In the Charette and in all those discussions, there were other points of view that were put forward in terms of what Smith could have done.
And I think the important point on that, Joel, is what Smith could have done and what Smith opted to do and what Smith was allowed to do. Smith could have done any number of things. I'm not sure that putting them on, and by the way, it was state-owned property, Hospital Hill wasn't. We were invited to participate in giving our wish list what we wanted for that, but ultimately, that was the state's disposition.
Well, but they bought all that property going up the hill. They own that. Smith, if they wanted to, they
oh, you
said
they putting didn't it want on to. Smith property. They wanted they put had, on Smith property.
Yeah, they wanted to expand their campus.
Yeah,
the
agreement has been given eventually for them to take out Green Street, right? I mean, that's part of the agreement, the overlay district.
Yeah, the overlay district.
Eventually they will take out Green
what
Street.
What they own. I mean, they own the properties they own.
But isn't there some intent, as I understand it, that Green Street as a thoroughfare will no longer be. That's what they want.
I'm not sure what the plan is on that, but the fact is that what happens is the property, they control the property on both sides, and the fact that the city would have to pay for that as a public way is, that means we would have, I think people will be rightfully upset to suggest why should Northampton pay to subsidize and maintain a street that belongs solely to Smith College. I mean, I think, and these, you know, and this is the thing, is the situation you describe is kind of broad and wide and sweeping, and there's point counterpoint to all of this stuff, and I don't entirely disagree with the sentiment. I don't, but the fact is that there are circumstances that really do create certain pressures. What the council's capable of doing is, and here's the difference, and I've often had this conversation within myself, you know, coming as an activist, I used to be an activist, now I'm a legislator, and there's a distinct difference, because I'm now have, I as an activist, I was serving a constituency, one, and the people I felt that I was helping. As a legislator, I'm serving a constituency of even people who don't believe in me or even trust me or even think I should continue to draw breath. But the fact is I'm obliged to consider those perspectives. And then so the way we, rather than charge the ramparts as a city hall, I put in jeopardy the community, the resources from the community, the dwindling resources we get anyway, we put in jeopardy. So what we do is we're left to lobbying, and we do that. And part of what I was talking about, what we're lobbying for, is a fair, more just taxation system. And to try and subvert the cynicism of saying we're going to offset economic woes by legalizing casinos, mm-hmm. or increasing another aggressive tax system, the lottery, which is predicated on people's dreams and hopes. No wealthy people play the lottery. And sales tax and fees on water usage and things like that. They're all secret gotcha taxes for people who can ill afford them. And consequently, it creates these deserts of economic diversity. And it contributes to the trend towards gentrification. And it makes it more and more difficult, because we're very limited as what we can do as far as making rules and regulations. We can do zoning, and we can stop people from hitting other people and stuff like that. But we can't tax. We don't have the authority to tax beyond property tax.
Is there a way for the city to say that there can be another economic way that things are done? Support, and that's where, like with this building we're in right now, the Florence Community
right,
Center,
right.
and the putting out to bid. My concern I expressed beforehand is, you know, we made sure that Kolmorgan would stay in town, and it got that pristine, beautiful top space there, and a lot of effort was made, as far as I understand, to keep that building there.
Right.
Gary Anderson did a lot of work.
And that came with a cost to Kolmorgan. It wasn't like we set them up for free and built them a beautiful building and said, please stay, please stay. The fact is that they invested in the property.
Well, and they get their investment back. It's not
The fact is that when we're talking about Florence Grammar School, it becomes a little trickier because, of course...
Well, the question that I had... Let's see now. Bren Roses, here we are. Oh, no.
It's the office phone.
Oh, that's the office phone.
The question I have is, could the city government had made more of an effort to in this instance, with this building, keep it in the public trust?
Florence Grammar.
I think that what we were looking at, and I've heard Dave Pomerantz talk about this too, was the $1.2 million in improvements that this building needs just to be able to meet building codes. There was a decision a while back that the city can ill afford to maintain many of its own buildings. I mean, many of the buildings that it uses for governmental use, never mind those that it is leasing out to other tenants. And so the practice has been, when possible, to surplus, especially in a time where if you've been following any of our budget discussions, you know that we're facing extreme cuts mm-hmm. to schools, police,
right.
Departments right down the line. So, you know, at some point priorities need to be made in terms of what we can afford. So this will bring us, I think the purchase price was $370,000. The appraised value was $270,000 or something, given the amount of asbestos and other things that are in the building.
But I understand that, and this is where that marketplace logic comes in, and I think takes away from thinking differently. There's this idea of land trusts, of building cooperatively owned buildings, of keeping something in the public trust. Now, I understand things are tight. $1.2 or $1.5 million is a lot, and it's not a lot in the realm of what exists, right? There are foundations out there. There are places where who want to support the idea of cooperative economics. And Mr. Pomerantz said that last year they cleared $5,000 above and beyond what the expenses were for this building.
That's also largely due to the fact that there was just minimal maintenance done.
Right, right. I'm just saying it's not draining the city budget at this point. It's not making a lot of money, but it's keeping it in the public trust. And to support the idea of let's make an effort, we have a lot of people in town in the region who are interested in cooperative economics. Let's see how we can keep this in the public trust and figure out and even go to Smith College as one way to make the barons of our time, so to speak, in our community, you know, who get their money from the 1%. Their endowment back over, I think it's back to over $1 billion.
Oh, it's more than that. Yeah.
You know, at this point, their losses have been recovered. So figure out ways to use their resources and push them to say, let's create a building in the public trust. We only have 2 minutes
left here. So okay. I don't think that's an unreasonable request, and it actually did come up in the course of the discussion. Ultimately, I think what happens is that because of the pressures that you described, it beyond just the $1.2 million for the maintenance and abatement issues and accessibility issues and things like that. And again, actually, it's almost a social justice issue too, because we didn't have the means to create an accessible system for the community to use in the full breadth of what it should be able to use. There's all these frustrations that come with that. And in the end, essentially, you're right. It was an economic decision in many respects, because we make bad landlords. The city is not a particularly good landlord. Not to say that we're terrible. It's just that we're not. That's not our skill set, and nor should it be our commitment. We should be reinvesting in the schools, and we should be reinvesting.
Well, I disagree. I mean, you can create committees, right, Bill? As the city council president, you can make a committee.
Yes. Well,
for a cooperative economics, for preserving the commons, and bring people in and say, let's figure out how we're going to make this building a building that stays in the public trust. It's bringing another logic into it. Or for the Roundhouse parking lot, is there a cooperative economic scheme that can be set up?
Well, actually, in that case, it's a little trickier, because we don't actually own the land, we own the airspace.
Okay.
So that's we can make a collective common in the air.
Good ideas for the future.
We're out of time here.
We'll be back.
Thank you. I thank you, Maureen, Councilor Maureen Carney, and City Council President Bill Dwight for being here, and Brianna. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
This is the Bread and Roses Show. I'm Joel Sachs, and stay tuned for Democracy Now!